Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Matthew Shores for Appellant United Health Group. This Court has repeatedly held that a district court commits reversible error when it enters summary judgment sua sponte and without notice to the parties. That's precisely what happened here with respect to United's claim for $35 million in covered defense costs. In October of 2013, the district court ordered the insurers to brief three specific issues in a motion for partial summary judgment. Not only did that order not include defense costs, it specifically carved out defense costs. Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. I am an attorney at United Health Group, and I'm making an appearance here. So the order not only didn't include defense costs, it specifically carved out defense costs for further proceedings, and that was at page 606 of the appendix. The insurers, true to that order, filed a motion with respect to those three issues the court had identified, and that's very clear at page 609 of the appendix. There's not one word about defense costs in that motion. Yet when the district court entered its summary judgment order in September of 2014, it also summarily adjudicated United's claim for $35 million in defense costs. So for that reason alone, the decision should... Correct, Your Honor, 56F2. We did not, Your Honor, but it's precisely because we had no notice. What the cases hold. The issue is preserved for appeal, Your Honor, when the order issues. That's precisely what the cases hold in Heisler, American, Red Cross, and what...
I haven't read all those cases, but I don't accept that in this context.
Well, Your Honor, what...
When there's an ambiguous presentation of a summary judgment motion and somebody thinks that they were surprised, and I had a lot to say about that, Your Honor, but I didn't think you wanted to hear it yet. To me, the obvious and absolutely almost essential thing to do is to go back and tell it as before. It needs to do more.
So a couple of responses, Your Honor. First, there was no ambiguity. It was clear the defense costs were carved out.
But obviously, there's substantial disagreement as to that.
I don't think so, Your Honor. The insurers do not... The insurers do not take issue with the fact that the order was sua sponte or without notice. What they take issue with is the waiver point Your Honor is addressing. What the case is...
Why should the rule be that if there's then a two-month period or whatever before a final judgment that the party who's aggrieved needs to raise it with the district court? Why shouldn't that be the rule?
Your Honor, because the only vehicle for doing so would be a motion for reconsideration. And neither this court nor, to our research, any federal court of appeals has ever required a motion to reconsider to preserve an error. And what the clear line of cases that includes Heisler, American Red Cross, and Murphy say is it is issuance of the order itself without notice that constitutes the error. So that error was preserved for review at the moment it was issued. What the insurer's cases say is something altogether different. If you look at the SureValue Stamps case, for example, that says that if the court indicates to the parties that it is considering addressing a summary judgment issue sua sponte, and the party does not object at that time, that it has waived an objection to that vehicle, to that procedure sua sponte. That's also consistent with the text of Rule 56F2. But when, on the other hand, the order is without notice to the parties and it's sua sponte, that per se constitutes reversible error, and there's no further action that needs to be taken in district court to preserve that error. That's what Heisler says. That's what American Red Cross says. And I think the last rule that district courts would want is the first rule that we, to our research, would ever have come from a federal court of appeals requiring reconsideration in order to preserve an error. I would like to turn to the indemnity issues. The district court also erred in summarily adjudicating United's claim for $105 million in defense costs. Now, the court did not enter summary judgment on the grounds that United failed to prove coverage. On the contrary, the court concluded in its 2011 orders that the antitrust claims United settled in the AMA case were covered claims under both the main insuring agreement and the antitrust endorsement. Nor did the court find that summary judgment was appropriate because an exclusion overrode that coverage. The court instead found that United failed to meet its burden of allocating between covered and uncovered claims in that settlement. That was error for several reasons. First, an insured opposing summary judgment has no burden to allocate between covered and uncovered claims. An insured instead has a burden to prove that it settled a covered claim and thereby incurred damages. United concededly met that burden by introducing evidence that was admitted by the district court that it settled the AMA case for $350 million, and the expert evidence from its expert James Halverson that the antitrust claims alone that were part of that settlement were worth between $350 and $500 million. That evidence readily met United's burden as an insured opposing summary judgment of showing that it had suffered damages. There are no cases that we found that say that an insured's burden is farther than that and must allocate, let alone with precision, between covered and uncovered claims. Even if the United failed to meet that burden and there was an allocation required, the summary judgment order was still incorrect for two reasons. First, if the district court's reasoning was correct, that allocation has to be done at summary judgment, it has to be done with precision, and it has to be done with expert evidence, the insurers failed to meet their moving burden of showing that the part of the settlement that was uncovered was so significant and... Yes, Your Honor, the district court did. But if you apply... Not at all, Your Honor. Even if the burden did shift, what I was trying to do was point out what the insurer's burden was at summary judgment. It was to demonstrate the absence of a material fact. And as applied here, that would mean the absence of fact from which a rational jury could conclude that the covered portion of the AMA settlement reached the attachment points of the insurer's policies. And they introduced no evidence of that. In fact, they introduced no expert evidence at all. So if you start with the presupposition, as the district court did, that allocation has to be done with precision, they didn't meet their moving burden. But even...
Does that cost of $35 million, does that reach any attachment?
What we would show on remand, if the court reverses on that issue, Your Honor, is that if you combine those $35 million in costs with the other claims that were later subject to dismissal by stipulation, it would reach the attachment points. So even if the burden did shift to United, United readily met its burden of showing that a rational...
On that last point, what do you mean by the claims that were subject to dismissal by stipulation? Would those be somehow revived?
They would, Your Honor. There was a clear stipulation that we reserved all of our rights with respect to those claims. That's a stipulation that appears at 1266 of the appendix. What we did
is... What does that mean, to reserve your rights? I mean, are they dismissed or not?
They were, by stipulation, and it was the posture was...
With prejudice?
The posture was as follows, Your Honor. After the summary judgment order that summarily adjudicated not just defense costs, but also the AMA indemnity claim, the counts that remained didn't in and of themselves reach the excess layers of insurance, and those counts are essentially two. One was the New York Attorney General proceeding, which had a $50 million penalty, and which also had $5 million in defense costs. So that was to $55 million. There were also sort of a category of cats and dogs of denied claims that in totality were $25 million. So what happened after the summary judgment order in September of 2014 is we were left with a situation... Your Honor, I don't think so. What happened is following that...
What you're saying is we carefully preserve is not...
If
the only way that we conclude there is a legitimate final order is to say that dismiss claims and dismiss these outright with prejudice.
Your Honor, I don't think that rule applies here. And the reason is, after the summary judgment order in September of 2014, there were roughly $80 million of coverage at issue in the remaining claims. But there was no dispute between the parties that $80 million in and of itself did not reach the excess layers of insurance, which started at $95 million. So rather than have a trial that was essentially moot, the parties stipulated to the entry of judgment. And the stipulation is very clear that in stipulating to that entry of judgment, United was reserving all of its rights, not only to appeal the summary judgment order, but to reassert the New York AG and denied claims on remand. So there's no problem with the finality of that order, Your Honor. And even if the burden did...
Appealed the dismissal of the AG claim and the cats and dogs claim?
Yes, Your Honor. That's encompassed within the appeal. We've appealed the final judgment, and that includes the dismissal of those claims under the stipulation. But even if the burden shifted to United to allocate between the covered and uncovered claims, United met that burden. United introduced evidence that it settled the AMA proceeding for $350 million. It introduced expert evidence that the value of the covered claims alone as part of that settlement were at least worth $350 million. And it allocated to Malchow, the separate proceeding, $160,000 for the named plaintiff's claims because that was all that was asserted then. And under the U.S. Supreme Court decision of Smith v. Bear, that was the appropriate way to handle that case at the time because it was uncertified class action. Now, what the insurers say is that that didn't meet United's burden. What United had to do was allocate between the AMA case, which was overwhelmingly an antitrust case at that point, 99% of the RICO and ERISA claims had been dismissed, and what remained was concededly covered, and the Malchow case. And what they insisted was that the Malchow case needed to be considered as essentially a competing class action. Even if that were the right way to allocate, and we don't think it is under Smith v. Bear, United easily met its burden. And all you really have to do is kind of step back and look at what was at issue in those cases. In AMA, it was a case that had been there was no specific demand in the Hiscox action. That was a demand under a different set of insurance policies for not just the Malchow case, but also... Correct. There was no specified demand, Your Honor. The record, even if the court does admit that into the record, it doesn't show that. And I think it bears noting, Your Honor, that that also included the New York Attorney General claims. So even if you assume that there was a $120 million assertion there, you at a minimum have to deduct $55 million for New York AG between the penalties that United paid and the cost imposed there. So again, even if all inferences are against this on Hiscox, Your Honor, at most that would be an allocation to Malchow of $65 million. That was out of $350 million that United paid to settle the AMA case. And to reach the attachment points, all we had to show was that a rational jury could conclude that $95 million out of that $350 million, roughly one quarter of the settlement, should be allocated to covered antitrust claims. We absolutely met that burden, even if the insurers are correct about Hiscox, which they are not. But I think the important thing to look at in terms of these settlements is just comparing them, kind of stepping back and asking what's at issue in the cases. The AMA settlement was a proceeding that had been pursued across the entire United Healthcare enterprise, not just one subsidiary, for 8+ years. It had antitrust claims that had survived a motion to dismiss and that alleged that another United Health Group affiliate, Ingenix, was at the hub of a conspiracy with the major national health insurance companies and was supported by a Code Blue report issued by the New York Attorney General indicating that Ingenix was operating under a conflict of interest in so doing. That was AMA. That was what was settled, and that was what our experts said in and of itself, those covered antitrust claims were worth $350 million. If you compare that to what was at issue in Malchow, Malchow is, if you think about a Venn diagram, it was a wholly encompassed dot within the AMA settlement. Malchow was pursued much later, 8 years later, included only one set of United Healthcare subsidiaries, Oxford, which comprised 6% of the overall settlement class of AMA. Had no antitrust claims, had no Ingenix as a co-defendant, and was asserting the same ERISA claims that had failed in the AMA proceeding. There is no way that the insurers met their burden of saying that that Malchow uncovered action so dwarfed everything else that was concededly covered in the settlement that no rational jury could conclude. I only mean that, Your Honor, in the sense of their burden in moving for summary judgment. But even if you think of it as our burden.
All I have to do is say that you have the burden and you didn't meet it.
So, and then again, Your Honor, even if that's the case, then United easily met its burden of showing that the AMA covered claims that were settled.
A lot of these facts that you're throwing out, supposed facts about what's obvious, could have been proved by settling attorneys. But you.
That's correct, Your Honor. Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but the district court agreed with us that that was not required because the contemporaneous allocation, And Your Honor, there were perfectly valid reasons for doing so. There were major copycat class actions pending all across the country on these same issues. United, you know, made a tactical decision, but certainly an advisable one, not to allow the plaintiff's lawyers to sort of peer behind the tent to see what was going on in terms of our thinking about those cases. The district court correctly concluded that we could prove with objective evidence after the fact how the settlement should be allocated. What was really important to the district court was the art dealer analogy, and I just want to spend a minute on it. What the district court held is that United had in effect presented evidence that it had purchased two pieces of art from an art dealer, and the first was a Picasso and the second was wrapped behind brown paper, and they had purchased both for $50 million. And what United's expert came in and said was the first Picasso in and of itself is worth $50 million. And what the district court reasoned is that's insufficient because without knowing what's behind the second wrapped paper, you can't do a relative comparison between those pieces of art. And I think that's incorrect for three reasons. First, even if that's correct, it doesn't warrant the completely opposite conclusion that the Picasso that our expert valued at $50 million was worthless as a matter of law. At a minimum, that there would be an allocation question that would be a question of fact for trial, as this court held in Nostaway. Second, we were entitled, as the party opposing summary judgment, to the inference that the second piece of art was worthless. We had introduced evidence from our expert that the Picasso we purchased was worth $50 million. That was absolutely sufficient, as the party opposing summary judgment, to show that we had suffered damages under the terms of the policy. And then third, we had actually, just to follow up with the hypo, we had uncovered the second piece of art and shown that Mao Chow was an uncertified class asserting $160,000 and was the tail and not the dog of the AMA settlement. At a minimum, that was a question of fact. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Morning, Your Honors. My name is Ronald Chiller, and I would like to use 15 minutes to discuss the allocation issue. Mr. Pearson will be addressing for National Union the notice issue, and I will be speaking for all four appellees on the allocation issue. First, Your Honor, I want to address, Your Honors, I want to address a question that the panel raised to start with, which is the $35 million of so-called defense costs, and which actually, as you honors know from the briefs, we contest and say isn't even worth $35 million. But as a practical matter, the first policy is the executive risk policy. It attaches or incepts at $128 million. To go to an issue that Judge Colleton mentioned, there is a circuit case law. There was a judgment entered in this case that provided that each of the other counts were dismissed for purposes of the appeal. It did not say without prejudice. It said the counts were dismissed. And as the circuit is well aware of, the Minnesota Pet Breeders case from 1994 and a litany of cases since then has said that an appellant takes its risk, and it's a mighty big risk, when it puts aside other claims that it believes, even when aggregated with claims that it wants to take up on appeal, could survive to make that argument later. And to correct the record on one other thing, there is no appeal before this court of the NYAG $54 million claim or the $20 million so-called denied claims or cat and dog claims, as appellant referred to it. The court will not see any briefing on those issues. They were dismissed pursuant to a separate paragraph in the judgment entered by Judge Schiltz. To be clear, and this addresses a question from the panel, this was not a sprung on the party's judgment. This was a negotiated judgment that took months to arrive at.
I thought the point was, though, that those claims admittedly had no merit if the defense costs were not included because you wouldn't get up to the limit.
We contended that those claims had no merit either way, and that in order to even stretch to make them potentially relevant, and this is important, first off, if you aggregated or in insurance parlance related them, they all had to be whole. They had to be subject to no defenses, and contrary to what appellant said, we did have the additional defenses. Judge Schiltz had construed only the Lexington primary policy, but in one of his rulings that the panel's familiar with, he concluded that defenses and exclusions in the executive risk and other policies would be saved for another day. We had those arguments to make, ultimately, so that if they were going to take an appeal on those separate counts that were dismissed with prejudice and in a judgment, we could have teed those issues up for the panel, too.
You could ask to affirm on that ground, but those issues are still open.
We respectfully believe that those issues,
they could be open on remand.
They could be open as to one of the policies, not the other three appellees here, if everything were aggregated and if they hadn't waived these issues and if they hadn't asked Judge Schultz to enter a final judgment on all counts, separately listing every other count, not just counts 5 and 6, which go to the AMA issue. And we don't, and so, yes, there is that contingent possibility, if we went back down, that the district court judge could have all of these issues in yet another phase trial. They elected not to go to that phase trial then with a separate paragraph in the judgment that is not without prejudice. And as the Minnesota Pet Breeders and other cases made clear, even when they have been without prejudice, this court has concluded that they would be treated as with prejudice, with the only exceptions being in cases involving absent class members whose rights needed to be protected and things of that sort, which don't apply here. On the issues of allocation, the issue that the district court found was that the so-called the dot on the Venn diagram had no factual evidence to be presented in the record to invite a jury to do other than speculate, because not of decisions made by the trial court, but of decisions that started in 2008 by United. And were consistently applied since 2008 through the summary judgment arguments and motions years later. And these were issues that were presented to magistrate judges, two separate magistrate judges, where the insurers, and following up on a question from Judge Loken, I was on the briefs, and we were in those arguments where we tried to get the contemporaneous evidence and tried to get information about what the defense lawyers for United Healthcare received, what they were thinking. If we couldn't get into their thinking, at least what they were discussing with other people at the time, and what informed the decision to settle in January 2009. We were blocked. We were successfully blocked. We were told that this would be the subject of an expert report. And the law of Minnesota is really not in question here. It's the Borson case. It's the Notaway case, pronounced Nostaway by appellant a minute ago. And to be clear, Notaway is an Eighth Circuit decision that says that the burden is on the insured and that the insured, if it doesn't meet that burden, loses. And to be clear, Notaway was construing Missouri law, but it has been cited from Minnesota law as well, for example, in the Piper Jaffrey case. This is not controversial, and the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Borson case in the 1980s said the same thing. It's never been a controversial proposition. The burden is on the insured when there are both covered and non-covered or uncovered claims or entities. Now,
what I heard him saying today is either it should have gone to a jury to decide how much the dot was worth, or they're entitled to an inference that it was worth zero because they showed how much the AMA claim was worth. And I gather your answer to the first is it would be too speculative to send it to a jury?
It would be too speculative because they had no admissible evidence to get to the jury on the value of the covered piece of art or Mao Chow. And to be clear, Your Honor, this is not a case involving multiple claims involving one insured, and you can get into an argument about how much did the value of that additional claim really add. Mao Chow, which was the case pending in the District of New Jersey before Judge Hochberg, was an independent action before a judge who had another case, the Health Net case, before her, and was an ERISA-only case. She had decided in that other case, and we respectfully requested that a supplemental appendix put this before Your Honor, but it's in these are published decisions. And she had decided in the Health Net case that administrative remedies did not have to be exhausted the way Judge McKenna in the Second Circuit AMA case decided they did have to be exhausted. My point, Your Honor, is this is getting into some pretty detailed discussions of legal decisions, a history in a separate case with different claims, and their expert witness, Mr. Halverson, said he hadn't read Mao Chow. He wasn't familiar with what it was. On further questioning, he thought he might have heard of it. He did no analysis of Mao Chow. We had no witness to put in front of a jury on their side or cross-examine, and we certainly couldn't cross-examine Judge Hochberg or Judge McKenna, even if their opinions, post or pre-settlement, were not hearsay and were admissible. We had nobody to put before a jury, a fact finder, non-speculative information or anything to essentially make it relevant, non-speculative, and meet their burden. And this was not a situation where, and it's a little bit cute in their reply brief to suggest otherwise, where one action was uncertified and another was. Neither Mao Chow nor AMA were certified. They were hard-fought litigations. AMA had gone on for a long time, and even when there was a settlement reached in January 2009, Judge Hochberg would not stay the Mao Chow litigation. She only stayed it when the settlement was approved sometime later and then was going to include Mao Chow plaintiffs. So this was an independent action. It was not like even the cases the Minnesota courts have said you have to allocate that one could argue are closer, involve parties in the same litigation, involve claims and non-covered claims in the same litigation. It was a wholly separate action against what was, under the language of the policy, not a protected person. Oxford was not an insured. United Healthcare never contended, and this was a little bit blurred over in their briefing and in the statement that the panel just heard, Oxford never contended that Mao Chow was covered or that Oxford was a protected person or an insured under the policy. So the entire time that went on, United Healthcare agreed that Mao Chow was not covered under our policy. It was only after, involving, to address a question asked by the panel, Judge Schultz ruled in the Hiscox case, which was the second tower from 2007 and 8, that tower did not cover United Healthcare for the Mao Chow action, that they suddenly decided that what they had conceded in our complaint and never amended and never took away, our coverage complaint in this case, that they were seeking only coverage for only a portion of the $350 million, suddenly the portion became 100%. Now, if you actually read the language of that paragraph, you will see that paragraph 3, that it says there's a Mao Chow litigation, there's the AMA litigation, and the third sentence is we are seeking in this lawsuit, the AMA, coverage for the AMA portion. Couldn't be clearer. And throughout that complaint, they don't call it what United calls it in this court now, the AMA settlement. It's the AMA / Mao Chow settlement, recognizing that there were two pieces, one was not covered. They have always conceded that. And so they have always conceded that they would need to prove it. They blocked us, and they had every right, if they wanted to take that risk, just like the way they took this appeal, if they wanted to take that risk, they had every right to say, we're not going to let you get this evidence. We opposed that. We were unsuccessful. But if they did that, if they barred their attorneys, if they elected not to use certain claims history data to actually prove what was settled, and they did, then they had to, as they told the magistrate judges and the trial judge, the Article III judge, they had to present an expert who would testify to both pieces. And the short answer to the rebuttal, to the art analogy that you heard from appellant, is simply that if you have $50 million spent on two pieces of art and you don't know the value of the other piece of art, you really don't know if the Picasso is worth $50 million, $1 million, or actually was done by Picasso's kid. We don't know. And we will never know because they made the decision not to have Halverson testify about Mao Chow, not to present him as an expert on ERISA or RICO. And by the way, these were also issues in the AMA litigation. that they would have had to, even as to that litigation, they would have had to allocate for. And again, Mr. Halverson admitted he was not an ERISA or a RICO expert. Now, we also take issue with whether or not he had a sufficient foundation under Rule 702 and Daubert to even offer the opinions as to AMA at all. And that was something that was briefed before this court. And the reason that we said that is that he ultimately admitted he did no independent antitrust analysis. He was not provided with anything from the underlying case. This is not to say that a case can't be settled before it goes through full discovery and still be valued. But he didn't attempt any valuation. He didn't attempt to do an antitrust but-for evaluation. What United Healthcare suggests in coming up with its back-of-the-envelope argument for a de minimis or non-existent value of Malchow is that it can take a series of rulings, very sophisticated rulings, from two different judges over the course of years and essentially argue them to a jury. We're not allowed to cross-examine the witnesses doing the arguing. We're not allowed to ask the judges who wrote them whether they considered whether the Third Circuit would agree with the Second Circuit, because the District of New Jersey is in the Third Circuit, and the Southern District of New York is in the Second Circuit, and they don't always agree on exhaustion of administrative remedies, and how that would turn out. Now, we could have avoided this if they had an expert witness to testify about these things. They had no admissible evidence. As to the value of the so-called Malchow litigation, they did sue the Hiscox Tower, that 2007 to 2008 tower. And they did sue for $120 million. And the reason they did that is they had a $50 million SIR or deductible, self-insured retention or deductible. And they sued for $70 million above that. And presumably they didn't sue for more above that because there were policies above that with an arbitration agreement in Bermuda. But we don't have to go there. The point is, until they lost Malchow in front of the same judge who had the same issues, and it was the same case in terms of Ingenix, it's just it was in front of a different judge with different theories. They were contending that a very substantial portion had to be valued and had real value. I'm finished with my time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am speaking on behalf of Appley National Union with respect to the notice issue. National Union and United entered into a contract pursuant to which the parties agreed and United agreed that in order to invoke coverage under the policy, it would provide notice of claims, it would report claims to National Union within the policy period and to National Union's claims department at 175 Water Street in New York. A simple, straightforward claim reporting mechanism. This court and numerous circuit courts around the country, six by last count.
Hypothetically, if we affirm the district court on the allocation, I guess maybe National Union isn't even exposed on the defense press. Is there anything left to do?
No.
Hypothetical only.
Understood, Your Honor, but clarity is important. Circuit courts around the country have recognized the importance of these claims made and reported provisions. They are important and an essential part of the bargain between the insurer and the insured because they give certainty to the insurance company regarding what claims are presented under the policy, what claims they have exposure for, and they can appropriately set reserves, evaluate the claims, and usually provide insurance at a less costly premium than other types of policies. The evidence before the district court and before this court is undisputed. Despite the straightforward, simple reporting requirement of the policy, United did not comply. There is no evidence in this record that anyone from United affirmatively transmitted notice of this claim to National Union's Claims Department in New York City.
It went to some other department. Is that what happened?
Instead of complying with the policy, United argues, well, we did something else. We gave it, we may have given it to an underwriter in Chicago. We may have given it to Lexington Insurance Company in Boston. We may have given information about this claim to some people who attended a meeting in Minnetonka. None of these people are in the claims department in New York City. All of these hypotheticals that they raise reach the same dead end, Your Honor. That dead end is that none of those scenarios demonstrate that any notice was ever received by the claims department in New York. The undisputed evidence from the recipient's side of the equation is that notice was never transmitted to and received by the claims department in New York during the policy period. That is unrebutted. And there is no evidence by any United witness, any Marsh witness, its broker, or any of these people that they allude to in their scenarios who testify or no documents that demonstrate that notice was provided to National Union's claims department. So instead of complying with the policy, they offer a different...
Do we know what happened to what they did send?
We know this, Your Honor. We know that it never got to the claims department, and that should be the end of the inquiry. Most all of their hypothetical scenarios of notice have the same deficiency. It requires the court to speculate on the very issue that you are, a very question you have raised. Did that ever get to the claims department? The answer is no. It is United's burden to demonstrate they complied with a notice requirement of the policy. None of these hypothetical scenarios meet that burden. Let me offer two examples, Your Honor. They suggest that they gave information about this claim to an underwriter in Chicago by the name of Mr. Runnell, and that he was going to speak to his compatriots. The email is between two people from Marsh. There's no evidence that Mr. Runnell ever received information about this claim. There's no evidence who his compatriots were in New York. There's no evidence that he actually spoke to them about this claim. The same deficiencies permeate all of their hypothetical examples. They do not demonstrate in any way, shape, or form that United, that notice of the claim was reported to the claims department. They require speculation, and that speculation is not sufficient. Moreover, they're relying essentially on circumstantial evidence. And as the case law tells us, circumstantial evidence that is at war with the existing, the established facts, is not sufficient to carry the burden. The undisputed fact is United, the National Union, did not receive notice. They did not comply with the policy. There is no coverage. The district court's decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shores has time.
It's a little over 3 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. On the defense cost issue, the nature of this error is when it is sua sponte and without notice. That is when the error is preserved for review. The only additional vehicle that would have been available to us is to move for reconsideration. That is not required to preserve an error. As a practical matter, what happened after that summary judgment order was entered was that the remaining claims were moot. In fact, the stipulation, which appears at pages 1226 to 1231, makes very clear that that's the predicate for the stipulation, that the summary judgment order that was entered in September of 2014 rendered the remaining claims moot. This was not an effort to manufacture a final judgment. And there's no real practical alternative to the fact that a trial on those claims, which would have taken years, would still have reached the same conclusion, that those were moot claims. We preserved...
this with a defense cost, you need to revisit that because they're essential to avoid your order mooting these other terrific claims we have, right?
I understand, Your Honor, and I think the fact that it was essentially a partial summary judgment order doesn't change the nature of the error. In fact, in American Red Cross, that's exactly what happened.
No, but it means it a more substantive motion than simply to reconsider because we didn't have notice.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because
it affected the other claims too.
It did, but the claim had been summarily adjudicated. That was the order that was entered. The only vehicle to challenge that would have been a motion to reconsideration. And in American Red Cross, exactly the same posture played out, and it was still subject to error. On allocation, a lot of the arguments that Mr. Schiller made would be more befitting a jury verdict in their favor. They involved a lot of inferences being drawn against United, and that's contrary to Rule 56. Minnesota law is very flexible on allocation. It has permitted allocation on evidence like pleadings, attorney affidavits, review of the underlying transcripts, and whatever the burden is here, we met it. Mr. Schiller mentioned the Borson case, but I think that case is illustrative of how different our case is. That case was a case that right at the end of the settlement, the insured tried to essentially smuggle in an insured claim and then claim coverage for the whole settlement. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said there was no evidence to show that the covered claim was really part of the settlement. That could not be more different than this case. We litigated AMA for 8 years, settled it for $350 million, and introduced evidence that was admitted by the district court that the value of those covered claims alone was in excess of $350 million. Whatever the standard is, whether it's allocation or just showing that we suffered an incurred loss, we met that burden at summary judgment, and the decision should be reversed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you.